From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. When Diane Fossey was murdered at her camp in Rwanda, Africa, David Watts took over her pioneering research center, studying the behavior of the endangered mountain gorilla. Actress Sigourney Weaver stars as Fossey in a forthcoming film shot on location. Coming up, David Watts tells us about serving as the film crew's ambassador to the gorillas. Also today, I speak with Pat D'Inizio, the founder, lead singer, and songwriter of The Smithereens, a rock band whose songs are inspired by the bands D'Inizio grew up listening to in the 60s. Television critic David Bianculli muses on the plight of the TV critic during the writer's strike. And Bonnie Kolak is back to sing a romantic ballad in our weekly performance segment. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. In December of 1985, American naturalist Diane Fossey was murdered at the Karasoke Research Center in the mountains of Rwanda, Africa. She founded the center to study the mountain gorillas, but by the end of her life, she had virtually given up research to devote her full energy to protecting the gorillas against the threat of extinction. Fossey was controversial in the science world for getting too emotionally involved with the gorillas. In Rwanda, she was hated by many hunters because she ran patrols to prevent them from hurting the gorillas. 4 months after Fossey's murder, David Watts took over the direction of the Karasoke Center. It had previously been his home base for the 3 years he spent studying the mountain gorillas. Watts recently resigned and returned to the United States, where he's about to teach at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. But shortly before Watts left Africa, he became the intermediary between the mountain gorillas and Hollywood. Diane Fossey is the subject of a forthcoming feature film called Gorillas in the Mist, starring Sigourney Weaver as Fossey. Weaver, director Michael Apted, and the crew came to the Virunga Mountains to shoot on location. The gorillas Watts was studying became Sigourney Weaver's co-stars. I asked David Watts if he was enthusiastic when he first heard about the film.
No, before it happened, I wasn't pleased. I had a great sense of foreboding, partly for personal reasons having to do with the subject matter, but also I didn't like the idea of such a big project being done and of so many people being around the animals. The gorillas are very used to having humans around them, but we do interfere in their lives somewhat, and the more people there are around them, the more equipment, the more potential there is that they can really be bothered. And I had a few misgivings about what the long-term implications of a Hollywood film might be, but I also had misgivings about the possible immediate implications of having a film crew with a lot of equipment trying to work around the gorillas. I have worked with television documentary crews before, and there hadn't been any real problems, but these generally are people who make wildlife documentaries professionally. They aren't Hollywood studio people. And also, 35mm equipment is a lot bigger than 16mm equipment. And the Hollywood crew needed more backup equipment.
Well, I can think of a big difference between a wildlife crew and a Hollywood crew, and that is the wildlife crew is going to just want to watch the animals doing what they do, whereas a narrative film crew is going to want the animals to behave in a way that fits with the storyline, that's congruent with the script.
Yeah, I tried, in corresponding with them before it happened, I tried to make it clear to them that they couldn't come with any expectations about what they were going to film the gorillas doing. That, and in the end, they realized that they were simply going to have to work with whatever footage that they got and build their storyline around that rather than being able to direct the gorillas. And in the end, my misgivings weren't warranted, and a large part of the reason for that was that they hired a fellow named Simon Trevor, who is a Kenyan and is a wildlife cinematographer and a real African bush person, to be in charge of the unit that actually filmed the gorillas. So he was the perfect person for the job. He loves being around wild animals. He spent most of his life around wild animals and is more at home there than I am. So he had the required sensitivity and interest in the animals themselves. And everyone, all the humans, behaved themselves very appropriately. And there weren't any real problems around the gorillas.
So what was your job on the film?
My job was to be a consultant and also basically to be the ambassador to the guerrillas. The Hollywood people wanted specifically to work with one of the research groups, Group 5. These were, quote-unquote, Diane's guerrillas, and the names of many of them would be familiar to anyone who's read her book. And one of the reasons why they wanted to work, the main reason why they wanted to work with this group was that there is a tradition of actual physical contact between some of the guerrillas in this group and humans. But they wanted to have that kind of contact between Sigourney Weaver and guerrillas. They also wanted just to be able to get close to the guerrillas and have the guerrillas not very nervous with them around. And strangers can't do that on their own. They need to go with someone who is known by the guerrillas.
What was the most important thing that you felt you had to communicate to the cameraman and the director when the movie was going to be shot about how to photograph the guerrillas without intruding on their territory?
Do what I say. And pay attention to me because I know what I'm talking about. I was fairly confident that I could be aware enough of how the guerrillas were responding to the situation that that I could stop problems before they got out of hand, or see them coming and prevent them from coming up at all.
Were there any close calls where a guerrilla got really angry at one of the crew or one of the actors because they did the wrong thing?
No, there weren't. There were a few moments when the guerrillas were obviously annoyed or felt a little frightened, but nothing serious. There were a few close calls of a more playful sort where Maggie ran off with one of their lens cases one day. Maggie is the biggest thief in Group 5 and will steal anything that isn't strapped to you or nailed down. And Pablo is a now 13-year-old male who's very, very comfortable with humans and very big and strong and likes to do things like sit on you and pin you to the ground or grab you by the shoulder and drag you around, all in good fun.
Do you think that there's any connections between mountain gorilla behavior and human behavior? Does that interest you?
Yes, it interests me. It's more important initially to understand gorillas as gorillas, but there certainly is continuity, and the gorillas do have a lot to tell us about ourselves, I think. They do in two respects, one of which is that by better understanding the dynamics of the social behavior of gorillas or chimpanzees or baboons, we can hope to come up with a general understanding, what we might call the general laws of behavior, and it's a somewhat controversial question how far such laws might also apply to our own behavior, but I think they certainly do to some extent. On a kind of a more immediate level, it's interesting to look at such things as infant development in the gorillas or communication in the gorillas and make direct comparisons between their behavior and our own behavior. And some of that can be done in a very informal way. For example, when you spend time with the gorillas and are close to them and get to know them and then stop to think about it, you realize that there's an awful lot of communication that goes on between you without you're even needing to stop and think about it, because it's the same as what we do with each other. And you're sending signals that you would to another person, and they respond to them, and you respond to their signals as you would to another human, and it all works fine.
Did you learn the sounds that gorillas use to communicate and learn their gestures as well, so that you could send signals to them and understand what they were communicating to each other?
I wouldn't say that I have a complete understanding of all of their sounds. Some of them, yes, I learned, and some of them we make. I can't make all of them, but those that I could do, I would use. And partly as a matter of courtesy, and partly to smooth things and make it easier to be around them.
Courtesy to the gorillas?
Yeah.
It's like courteous to say certain things to them, to communicate certain things to them when you're around them, you've intruded on their space?
Yeah. For example, there's a sound, what we call a belch vocalization, which is something like and they give that in a lot of context, but one is that if someone has been sitting quietly, eating or just resting, and decides to get up and move somewhere, they will often do that. And when I noticed that, I thought, ah, well, if I'm sitting quietly and there's a gorilla near me who's got his or her back turned towards me, if I'm going to get up and move, before I move, I should do that. So it's a way of saying, I'm here and I'm about to do something. If you want to see what it is, you can pay attention to me so I don't startle them.
What other sounds did you learn to make that were gorilla sounds?
Well, there's one that's like, which is a mildly aggressive vocalization, which they do to me more often than I do to them, because I would always defer to them and not tell them I'm angry at you. I might sometimes do it to an infant who was trying to steal something from me, but I received that a lot more than I gave it. Those are basically the two that humans use frequently to communicate with the gorillas. There are others that the gorillas make, some of which I can't do myself anyway.
Did you practice those sounds before trying them out on the gorillas?
No, not really. I went out to see the gorillas not quite the first day that I was at Karasoki. I actually went out to look for poachers and saw a poacher before I ever saw a gorilla. But then the second day that I was there, I went out and was introduced to the gorillas and was immediately very close to them, and got on-the-job training in vocalizations.
Yeah, you mentioned that you were close to the gorillas. Now, Diane Fossey, as you said before, used to say that she sometimes preferred gorillas to people, and I think that some people who study gorillas and monkeys have this close feeling toward them in a way that researchers studying animals, other animals, might not. Perhaps mm-hmm. because monkeys and gorillas remind us a little bit of ourselves. Did you find yourself getting really close to the mountain gorillas that you studied, getting really involved with their family life, caring about them individually a lot?
Oh, yes. They, in fact, they, when I'm there, they really become the center of my own emotional life. You become very close to them, very concerned with them, and you know them as individuals, and you get to know their personalities and their idiosyncrasies, and they're wonderful. And yet, you have to be aware at the same time that your relationships with them are very one-sided, that they're not going to be that interested in you, and they're not going to accept you as if you're another gorilla.
What's the greatest compliment a gorilla ever gave you?
Well, there have been so many. That would be hard to answer. Maybe there was a time about a year and a half ago when Tiger, who was a silverback male, had been very badly hurt in a fight with gorillas in another group. And there's now a program of veterinary management of the gorillas there. And some of what's been done in the way of caring for the gorillas is a little controversial. There might be people who would say that at least in some circumstances you shouldn't interfere and shouldn't try to treat them if they're sick or injured. In that case, I decided that he was almost certainly going to die if he wasn't treated medically. And in talking with other people there doing conservation work, decided that we should intervene. And we tried to do it initially by shooting antibiotics into him with a dart pistol, but it didn't work very well the first day. In the meantime, I had been... This was a gorilla who had grown up with humans around him for all of his life, and I had spent days and days and days with him, and he knew me really well, and he would permit me really close to him and was very calm, even friendly towards me. And he let me give him some food while he was sitting there so sick. And I suggested that I try feeding him medicine mixed up with the food. And it worked. He took food from me that had antibiotics on it, and I can't be certain that it saved his life, that he wouldn't have survived anyway, but he certainly picked up after that. And it was an incredible experience, but what was most complimentary to me in a way, but also made me feel very humble at the same time, was the way that he started to respond to me when I would approach him with food and offer it to him. And he really showed gratitude. It's something that was very subtle. It just was in his eyes and in his expression, the way he looked at me. But it clearly was saying thanks for helping me out. And my kind of silent response to that was, it's the least I could do for you after everything that you've, all the vicarious pleasure that you've given me. But to have that gratitude was really an enormous compliment.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your work in Rwanda with the mountain gorillas, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is David Watts, and he took over as director of the Karasoke Research Center in Rwanda, Africa, after the death of Diane Fossey in 1985. Watts had worked with Fossey for 3 years before she was murdered. He has left Rwanda for now and will be teaching at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor this fall. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
David Watts is my guest, and we're talking about the mountain gorilla, which he has researched, and he formerly headed the Karasoke Research Center in the Virunga Mountains of Africa. After Diane Fossey's murder, you took over the directing position of the Karasoke Research Center.
Uh-huh.
You had been in the United States at the time of her murder. You had already left the center, this is my understanding, but you were invited back to direct it. Did you want to go? Did you just say yes when you were asked?
No, I didn't immediately just say yes. I had just recently come back from a long stay there. I love being around the gorillas. I love the place. I have a lot of human friends there, too. But it's not the easiest thing in the world to go off and live in such a socially deprived situation for long periods of time. And I had left in 1985, partly because I decided, well, it's enough for now. I want to go back and live with humans for a while. And I had been back in the human world for only a couple of months when Diane was killed. And I realized that I wasn't psychologically ready. Had it been other circumstances, I would have said, well, I want to spend some more time here before I go back into the field. I also realized that it was very important to go back there. I had a suspicion that if I didn't do it, that the place probably wouldn't continue. That's because there are only a few people who had a lot of familiarity with Karasoke and how it functioned in the first place, and the other people were committed to other things. And also, at that point, the Rwandan government would not have accepted someone they didn't already know, and they knew me, and were willing to say, yes, this person can come back. So I felt a very strong sense of obligation that I should go back. And once I got there, I didn't mind being there again. In fact, I was very happy to be there.
Was there a murder investigation in progress when you returned?
Yeah. I didn't get back until several months after she was killed, so by then the investigation was well underway.
Did that make studying the gorillas difficult because there was an investigation going on around you?
Well, it didn't. By that time, it was no longer going on around us at the camp or in the park, and it didn't impinge on our daily existence there in any immediate way. So, no, it didn't make going out to study the gorillas difficult. In fact, you could have this sense of unreality being off with the gorillas. Sometimes it's as if nothing else exists, including murder investigations. In other ways, so it was something that always was there in the air and that we all were concerned about and was rather difficult to live with.
I should think you'd be kind of spooked by it as well as concerned about it.
Sometimes, yes, I must admit. And it was very tragic, but I also had decided immediately when I was thinking about going back there, that I didn't face any personal danger, that whatever happened to Diane happened because she was Diane and because of the way she behaved, and I didn't think that I was that I would have any enemies who would do that to me.
Now, Diane Fossey had basically given up research herself over the last few years of her life, and she was devoting virtually all of her efforts to protecting the mountain gorillas. When you took over the center, did you want to change the direction it was headed in?
No. In fact, not so far as the conservation role of the center went. No one ever wanted to stop doing the utmost that we could to protect the gorillas. And in fact, the government there allowed activities at the center to go on without interruption and allowed the anti-poaching work to continue. And it's really the government that does most of the anti-poaching work now anyway. It's park guards who are government employees. So in that sense, no, I didn't want to change anything that was going on. But I did want to try to integrate the research end of things more fully with other people there doing other aspects of the conservation work, just to make relationships a little more cooperative than they had been in the past. And I also hoped that the research would be expanded to include more than just gorillas, and to look at other animals in the park and other aspects of the ecology of the area.
About how many mountain gorillas are left now?
Well, there are two populations that were in the past one continuous population, but now are separated by cultivated land. In the Virunga volcanoes, there are about 300, and then in the impenetrable forest in Uganda, there are 200-some animals left. So the total is about 500, which is more than we thought a few years ago. In fact, we know that the Virunga's population has actually increased in recent years, thanks undoubtedly to the better efforts at protecting the animals. But it's still very few gorillas.
What are the greatest threats now to the survival of the mountain gorillas?
Well, the greatest immediate threat is poaching. And most of the poaching is not directed at the gorillas. In fact, we don't know of any deliberate gorilla killings for several years now, which is good. But there are people who use traditional methods still, or occasionally even automatic rifles, to go hunt other animals in the park, mostly antelope, which they trap for meat. And the gorillas can be caught in those traps and can die or be maimed as a result of infections that they get. And the level of poaching is down, but it still goes on every day. So it's necessary to keep on trying to keep the poachers out of the park, or at least to find their snares and cut them down before they catch anything. But the more serious long-term threat comes from the growth of the human population and the needs of the human population in that part of the world. And the real conservation problems there, even the poaching, are like conservation problems everywhere, basically socioeconomic problems. In this country, socioeconomic problems go on at a different level, the level of, say, corporate profits versus quality of the environment. But in Rwanda, it's much more starkly a question of meeting basic human subsistence needs. Are people going to have enough to eat? Are they going to have wood to cook with or to build their homes with? Rwanda has the highest population density in Africa and a rapidly increasing population. And when you see the way that people are crowded already, it's difficult to be very optimistic about the gorillas' long-term prospects. But there have been a lot of very positive developments in recent years. The big question is, will people's lives there be improved sufficiently that they will be convinced that they can live without cutting down what's left of the gorillas' habitat? And that's the big threat to the gorillas, that they already have lost most of their habitat to humans, and they can't lose much more, and really they can't lose any more if we expect them to survive.
Well, hearing you talk, I can tell that you still really care about the gorillas that you studied when you were in Africa. And I can't help but wonder why you decided to leave and come back to the United States.
I do care about them. I miss them terribly, and I hope that I see them again before too long. But one important realization that I've had over the years of being here is that I'm not a gorilla. I mean, that sounds trivial, but it's not really. And
it took you a while to come to that realization.
Yeah, and I think anyone needs to spend, even someone who is able to spend long periods of time off in the field like that, needs to get away sometimes and to have another life in the world of humans, if only because eventually your job performance is going to go down if you just live off in the bush. I do have some obligations to come forth with the results of all the research that I've done there, and I reached a point where I needed to take a good space of time off and do some writing and data analysis because I found that it was impossible to get that done in Rwanda. But I certainly hope to go back there sometime before too long.
Does it give you a good perspective to have lived a long time in a very remote area, living around gorillas? Do you feel that you can take things easier than you might have without that experience? That it gives you a different perspective?
Yeah, I think it gives one a different perspective in a lot of ways, if you're at all open to a lot of things. For one thing, seeing the way the humans live there has made a big difference to me and the way I look at the world. Also, spending so much time by myself with the gorillas has made me see the people in my life very differently, and see my relationships with them differently, and they've become much more important to me. And it also, living that kind of life, which is very simple in comparison to what so many people in this country are used to, does make you, in a way, more at ease with the world, maybe in some ways alienated from the world back here too, but content with a little less than you might be otherwise.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
David Watts became the director of the Karasoke Research Center in Rwanda, Africa, after the murder of Dian Fossey in 1985. He recently worked with the film crew that was in Rwanda to make a movie of Fossey's life. That film, Gorillas in the Mist, starring Sigourney Weaver as Fossey, is scheduled to open in September. David Watts has returned to the United States and will teach at the University of Michigan in the fall. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, guest host Leanne Hansen speaks with singer Barbara Cook. In the 50s and early 60s, Cook was a leading lady on Broadway, starring in productions of The Music Man, Candide, and Plain and Fancy. Now she's best known as a concert singer and recording artist. I hope you can join us.
I fell in love with you first time I looked into them their eyes. You've got a certain little cute way of putting it. They make me feel happy, they make me blue. No stolen, I'm falling in a big way for sweet little you. My heart is jumping, you sure started something with them there eyes. You'd better watch them if you're wise. Those eyes, they sparkle, they bubble, they're gonna get you in a whole lot of trouble. You're overworking them, there's danger lurking in them, their eyes.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner, designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The Smithereens' new album might remind you of the Beatles, Brian Wilson, and the Kinks. Some critics have called the band's music classic rock. Others have called it retro rock. Coming up, we meet Pat D'Annizio, the lead singer and songwriter of the Smithereens. What has television done for you lately? With the writer's strike still on, probably not much. Our television critic, David Bianculli, says that the strike has made television criticism about as exciting as summer reruns. And singer Bonnie Kolak is back in our weekly performance segment. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Sharon Green. A federal judge today ordered the Justice Department not to perform random drug tests on its employees. NPR's Nina Totenberg has details.
Judge George Rivercombe noted that the Reagan administration had conceded at oral argument that there is no major problem of illegal drug use at the Justice Department. Nonetheless, the administration had argued that the drug testing program is necessary to prevent abuse in the future and to promote public confidence in the department. The government, said Judge Rivercombe in his ruling, must have something more than unfounded fears to justify an intrusive search such as this. The courts in most cases have required some individualized suspicion to require a drug test, said the judge, or some established history of drug abuse in sensitive positions. In the Justice Department program, however, Judge Rivercombe said, everybody was to be tested, including economists and secretaries in the antitrust division. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
President Reagan today told the families of American servicemen missing since the Vietnam War that settling the MIA issue was still a top priority in his administration and that he was ordering a study to serve as a reference for the next administration. More from Michael Richards.
President Reagan's speech to the League of POW MIA families today comes just after Vietnam announced it had agreed to a joint search with the U.S. for 70 servicemen, strongly believed by Washington to have been captured alive. In return, the Vietnamese want the U.S. to act more aggressively on Vietnam's request for economic aid. The administration has refused to link the MIA issue to economic questions, but in his speech today, President Reagan appeared to welcome Vietnam's latest initiative on settling the MIA issue.
It's in the interest of Hanoi to position itself for a new era and to help bring this to pass.
More than 2,300 Americans are counted as missing in Vietnam. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards in Washington.
The Soviet Communist Party today approved a timetable for sweeping changes in the way the country is governed. The changes were outlined at the recent National Party Conference, where Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev called political reform the key to economic improvements. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
The party's central committee today approved several measures aimed at assuring the political reforms don't get bogged down by bureaucratic opposition. That's been a problem for Gorbachev. He's had relatively little trouble winning endorsements for change, but great difficulty in getting the changes made. The political reform process begins with Communist Party elections this year and continues with next year's election of a new national legislature and president. Gorbachev today was appointed head of a new commission that will oversee the process of secret ballot multi-candidate elections. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
The wife of a U.S. Marine colonel kidnapped in Lebanon met today with U.N. Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar. Robin Higgins avoided the press following her meeting today in New York, but Perez de Cuellar said his office is making every effort to secure the release of her husband. Colonel William Higgins was chief of the U.N. Military Observer Group when he was abducted in February. He's one of nine Americans and nine other foreigners held by pro-Iranian factions in Lebanon. Iran has said it could intercede to obtain the hostages' freedom if the United States agreed to release Iranian assets frozen in the United States. Treasury Secretary James Baker is expected to take charge of George Bush's Republican presidential campaign before the party's convention next month. Bush spokeswoman Sheila Tate said that when Baker joins the Bush team, he will have the title campaign chairman. New York investment banker Nicholas Brady is reported to be the first choice to succeed Baker at the Treasury post. Stock prices ended the week sharply higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 46 points to close at 2128.74. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Some people say that a full moon makes you passionate, or crazy, or both. Chicago-based singer and songwriter Bonnie Kolak joins us today for a weekly performance spot with a song she wrote under the influence of the moon. Howard Levy accompanies her on piano.
I wrote this song a few years ago, and it was inspired by a very magical night out in the country. It was a night of the full moon, and it was so bright that you could see the shadows of the trees. And across the fields, you could see a really violent storm approaching. So there were stars. There was really sharp lightning and lots of fireflies. And it was a myriad of different variations of weather. And it was just such a magical night that it inspired the song that I titled, You Played Me Just Like a Piano. You played me just like a piano, and the music's from the moon and the stars. You played me just like a piano, and the song came straight from your heart. Was I following you? Were you following me? Isn't it amazing we're in the same key? You played me just like a piano, and the music's from the moon and the stars. You loved me so good in the moonlight, I fell asleep in your arms. You loved me through thunder and lightning, I forgot to be afraid of the storm. Was I waiting for you? Were you waiting for me? If fireflies were passion, we set them all free. You played me just like a piano, and the music's from the moon and the stars. One sweet night of magic, what more could I ask of you? Stars, you played me just like a piano, and the muses from the moon and the stars. You played me just like a piano, and the muses from the moon and the stars.
Bonnie Kolak with Howard Levy on piano. Bonnie's latest album, With You on My Side, is on the Flying Fish record label. This is Fresh Air. The Smithereens are a rock band with two guitars, a bass, and drums. The music of singer-songwriter Pat D'Annunzio was influenced by all the songs he grew up listening to on AM radio in the 60s. It's so evident that some critics have called the Smithereens' music retro or classic rock, labels D'Annunzio doesn't like. The Smithereens recently released their second album called Green Thoughts. In this summer's film, Bull Durham, there's a bar scene with a jukebox playing. If you listen carefully, you can hear Pat D'Annunzio singing the song Only a Memory from the new album.
My mind is filled with thoughts of you. I think about the days of two. Search the room, but you're not there. Your perfume lingers everywhere, but it's only a memory of what I thought was going to be. Only a memory, broken bits of you and me. Only a memory.
Only a Memory has a really good hook, and I wonder if you actually think about things like hooks in your songs when you're writing them.
Well, I'm very conscious about song structure, and I was always a fan of the classic pop songwriting structure, a structure or type of songwriting that was more prevalent in the 1950s and 60s, and those sorts of songs included hooks. There are hooks today in a lot of popular music, but it seems as though the song itself is being ignored in favor of writing songs around a beat or a drum machine.
So the hook comes first and then the song gets written around it for you?
It depends. Oftentimes I'll get a song title. The title Green Thoughts, for example, came out of nowhere. And it's not the kind of thing that I give a lot of thought to or that I would ever intellectualize. The songs, both musically and lyrically, tend to come out of nowhere.
I want to ask you about the song Something New. It's a song I like a lot. I'll tell you that I really like the lyric to it because the lyric is so so clean, so spare. Tell me about writing that song and about the lyric.
Well, quite frankly, that lyric came moments after a breakup with a girlfriend, and I was in the shower, and it just sort of hit. And the song sort of wrote itself. It's just that rare instance when, you know, you're not really thinking about it. That's why I'm particularly happy with those set of lyrics, although they are as simple as they are. They're very heartfelt. They have a lot of personal meaning to me. And I think that anyone who's been through a similar experience can relate to them.
It is time for something new for us to do. So, darling, dry your eyes. It's time for something new. Something new is what we need. Something new.
It's nice to hear a very unpretentious lyric, too. Something that's just simple and clean and straightforward.
Yeah, I've never really been into wordplay or being clever lyrically for the sake of being clever. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I need the lyrics to have some sort of meaning that I can relate to on some sort of emotional level, and hopefully that will translate into similar enjoyment for who's ever listening.
You know, I was listening to your song, Something New, and it was making me think about the Beatles' early songs. It seems a lot of your songs are almost homages to groups that you really like.
Mm-hmm. You know, you could say that. I personally believe that there's virtually nothing really new musically under the sun. Everyone is sort of taking what's gone by or the good things from the past and trying to reinvent them in some way. And anyone who has ears to hear it realizes that the song If the Sun Doesn't Shine on the Green Thoughts album is a definite homage to Brian Wilson.
It was on a day just like this that I first met you and we shared a kiss. Things that used to matter are no longer on my mind. Now it don't matter to me if the sun doesn't shine. Lie in bed Saturday.
You sing really well, and I was wondering if when you were young, if adults noticed that you can sing and if you had to perform at, like, kiddie talent shows and things like that.
Well, my parents were very much lower middle class working people. They both worked two jobs for years and years. And they weren't show business people or show business parents, as so many of our young performers seem to stem from that background. So I sort of had to find out by myself. And I learned to sing and developed my sense of vocal harmony by listening to Beach Boys and Beatles records and Yardbirds records and just singing along with the records.
Would you sing along, then turn down the volume and see how you did without the record?
I think the volume was on 10 most of the time, but 10 in 1966 or 67 was a lot different than it is now.
The Smithereens were formed in 1980, and from what I understand, you had taken out a classified ad looking for musicians to play with. I'm always surprised when classifieds actually work out well.
Yeah, it seems as though most of the people that actually do take out classified ads don't know what they're talking about. But in this case, I had gone through a period where I really became interested in writing songs, probably about the time that I saw the Buddy Holly story, the film version of that, and was fairly inspired by that. And I was looking for sympathetic musicians.
When the Smithereens started playing together, did you play a lot of cover recordings in addition to playing your own songs?
Yeah, for various reasons. In the early days, quite simply enough, we didn't have enough original material. We steadfastly at that point refused to do covers by the groups of the day who were more popular, like Foreigner and Soft Cell and whatever else was popular in the early 1980s. So in a sense, we were doing cover versions of songs that were song structure was very similar to what our original material was.
The Smithereens have opened for Lou Reed, The Pretenders, Los Lobos. When you're opening for someone like that, do you feel like it's their audience and that they may or may not really listen to you seriously while they're waiting for the main act to come?
Well, it's difficult to address that one. Sometimes you'll be offered an opening slot and it will make a tremendous amount of sense. And if you're proud of the work you do, obviously you want to expand your audience. So you have to make certain career decisions. I've always felt extremely compromised in the opening act situation, even if certain people have come there to see you specifically. You're compromised in terms of stage room, in terms of sound and lights. And basically you've agreed to put yourself into that situation.
The Smithereens strike me as being in this mid-level place in rock music now in terms of popularity. You're playing a lot of clubs. You're on MTV. Your previous record, I think, made it to the Billboard Top 100. You're not rock stars. You're not really famous, but you're not obscure either. Mm. You're kind of in the middle somewhere. What do you do now to take it to the next step? Do you want to go to a next step?
There are no conscious decisions. The only thing that we can do as musicians or quote-unquote so-called artists is just to do the best work that we can. If we could do what we do musically, which we've done virtually without change for 8 years and become tremendously successful, to me would not be a sellout in any way at all.
Pat DiNizio is the lead singer and songwriter of the band The Smithereens. Their new album is called Green Thoughts. The group is currently on tour. This is Fresh Air. Let's see how All Things Considered is shaping up. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
I understand it's a solo flight today.
That's right. Renee's holiday vacation begins today, so I'm all alone.
What story is he following?
Well, speaking of being all alone, we'll be talking with Anthony Storr. He's written a book about solitude and about how being alone in a different sense, not having close, intimate personal relationships, need not be a sign of psychological impairment. Also, progress attempted further in the Iran-Iraq talks at the United Nations. And we will hear part five of Daniel Pinkwater's Saga of the Malamutes, our week of dog stories.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Aside from the Democratic Convention, news and talk shows, and baseball, there hasn't been much new action on television for the past 5 months. But writer's strike and all, our television critic David Bianculli has still delivered one review a week for our show on top of the daily newspaper column he writes about television. If you were in his shoes, you'd be hoping for a strike resolution, too.
The first stories to come out about the writer's strike were the issue stories. What the fight was about, money, who was fighting, writers versus producers, and how it was likely to affect programming. Not much. Then, as the strike dragged on, the big story became, how is this going to affect the fall season? Then it was about how the poor writers were coping, and how the restaurants in Hollywood were losing money because nobody was working, and all this other stuff about how the writer's strike was making it tough for all the TV stars, executives, and caterers. Aren't we forgetting somebody here, though? I mean, granted, we're at the end of the TV food chain, but what about TV critics? You think it's fun writing about what you're watching when you're not watching anything new? So what do we do? Well, I can tell you what I do. I watch a lot of tapes of shows that are supposed to be on in the fall, but probably won't be. I write a lot more reviews of dinky little documentaries on public TV than I used to, because it's the only new stuff on. Say, where's that 6-part documentary on the history of metallurgy now that we really need it? I wait for one of the networks to remake an old show that I reviewed years ago so I can run a rerun of my review. And on slow weeks like this, I talk about how there's nothing to talk about. It's like TV coverage of the political conventions. When there's no story, the story is that there's no story. But wait, that's not all. I've done stories on how the writers should improve certain shows once they start writing them again. My favorite was to have them kill off the boring hero of Wise Guy and have Roger Lococo, another undercover agent who appeared on the show, come back to avenge his buddy's death and then stick around to work for Frank McPike as the new Wise Guy. I've done stories on new TV movies I like to see, like one that follows a Los Angeles teenage prostitute as she moves to a small town in the Midwest, falls in with the right crowd, and ultimately becomes a cheerleader, and maybe even a virgin. Heck, I've even made up my own complete network schedule from scratch. A week's worth of shows that could be made with old scripts, existing but unused scripts, or no scripts at all. You know, things like game shows, variety shows, live remakes of Golden Age dramas. My strangest idea, though, was to write a weekly serialized column for the duration of the strike, in which some of TV's characters would get together, led by J.R. Ewing, and decide to end the strike themselves by kidnapping NBC executive Brandon Tartikoff and holding him hostage until the strike is over. The plot was hatched by J.R. and Alexis and Arnie Becker and even Alf, and was going to be carried out by Jim Phelps of Mission Impossible, a character being revived by ABC in a brand new series based on old scripts. The problem was that idea was so strange that the first installment was rejected by my newspaper's editors. So you heard it here first. I still think it was a good idea, though, and it would have taken care of one column a week. I don't know. Maybe I ought to go on strike.
The ever-inventive David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time we'll hear from Nelson George. The author of Where Did Our Love Go? A History of Motown Records has a new book that traces the evolution of black pop from rhythm and blues to rap. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by trombonist Steve Ture, whose position in the Saturday Night Live band makes him one of the most visible jazz musicians today. And Ken Tucker reviews the new home video of Near Dark. It's an unjustly overlooked horror film, Ken says, so hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.